Your Next Big Move podcast for anyone involved in the buying and selling of businesses that wants to know how to do it right. Hosted by Zoran and brought to you by Exclusive Business Sales. Sell your business with certainty.
In today's episode, Zoran sits down with Stuart Boyd, a veteran of the acquisition world with first-hand experience on both sides of the deal. Stuart shares how he built and sold his own company, transitioned into corporate acquisitions, and what really happens when small businesses are absorbed by larger players. From managing seller expectations and staff transitions to navigating risk, warranties, and culture clashes, Stuart unpacks the realities many business owners don't see coming. If you're thinking about selling your business or just want to understand the process from the inside, this is an episode you won't want to miss.
Hello, Stuart. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you.
Well, thanks for doing this with us today.
That's okay.
All right, so you were head of acquisition for publicly listed company.
Correct.
How did that come about?
I had my own company.
Yeah.
I was in an industry for a long time, built my business up over 13 years, and then I was bought out by that company. So part of my role was transitioning the business out of my ownership and consolidating into the new company. That transition took 12 months to 18 months, making sure the customers were transitioned over, everything was smooth. And from that, that role then became looking after the acquisitions in Australia for that company. Basically, they had a lot of other bigger parts to their business. So my role was acquisitions for that specific industry type.
Okay. And so you had to search for the businesses, find the target, approach them, or was there the businesses that were already on the market?
No.
Okay, so
it was all cold. Okay. So
so how'd you go about it?
So I just ring them up.
Yep.
Basically, I ring them up, or if I meet them at conferences, I just ask them over and over and over and over.
And over.
Do they want to sell? Do they want to sell? And eventually, people say no, but then people always want to know what their business is worth. And that's a starting point. Mm-hmm. And then over the years, people, their situations change, and they then ring me back and say, yes, I'm ready to sell. Can you come and see me?
Do they ready to sell? Do they say they are ready to sell, or do they say, okay, look, let's talk?
They say, let's talk. Very few of them say, right, I'm ready to sell right now. But sometimes, but most of the time they want it, they don't understand the process at all. They've never sold a business. Most of them have been family-owned businesses that have been running for 20 years. So they've never done that before. So they really need to understand the process, how it works, what pressures they're going to come under, and how the negotiations will work.
So how many acquisitions have you done during your tenure?
Probably about 20.
20, okay. Yeah. What was the strategy behind it? Obviously, it was a growth. Yeah. Well.
Yes.
Kind of answer my own question.
The strategy for the buyer is pretty much plainly growth by acquisition, especially in an industry where they're already dominant. Becomes a tuck-in acquisition, and doesn't matter what the size is, small, big, medium. They can buy the business. They can remove sometimes up to 80% of the costs, and they just effectively buy customers. So you do an asset purchase rather than a company purchase, and purchasing the assets are really the assets that are required to generate the revenue and the customers. So the majority of the time for those businesses, it's not buying a standalone business. I mean, there were a couple of times when they ended up standalone, new industries into medical waste was a new one altogether, so they had to leave those structures in place. Most of the time, very high returns for buying an acquisition with good synergies. So those synergies mean that they've already got an existing fleet of vehicles.
Yep.
They don't need any of the fleet, the backroom people, the admin people. They don't need any of those, and they can remove those from the equation when they look at the profit return.
What size acquisitions were they doing?
Ranging from the lowest, probably just 500,000 or 600,000. Up to 8-10 million.
Okay.
So it varied. The industry was consolidated, and there was a few very large players, but there weren't many acquisitions above 10 million. So it was always between that 500,000, 600,000 around the 10 million mark.
And so when you're looking at the target, so first factor that you're looking at, it's a business that you're interested in.
Yes.
And that's how you were approaching them directly and or through conferences. But once when you find a business, what were the other factors you were considering?
The main factors are you're having a corporate buyer buying a business off a small to medium-sized business owner, completely different culture. So these people have built their business up for 20 or 30 years. They've got up every morning at 5 o'clock in the morning, gone to work, worked their day, got home at 6 o'clock, done their admin or their admin staff to do it, depending on the size. They're about to hand that over to somebody else and they're then going to wake up one day with money in the bank and nothing to do and their normal job's gone. So you sort of spend a bit of time with the seller. So even though I was acting for the buyer, majority of my work was with the seller. The buyers have their own accountants, solicitors, their own admin teams. They don't need that much input. I just need to package the financials up in a way that shows the existing P&L, P&L with normalisation, and then a P&L with synergies. Then I present that to the buyer. So the key factors for the buyer is fairly much around financials and also whether they can trust the seller. With corporates, if they feel that anybody is doing something dishonest, they won't even investigate it. They'll just walk away. So you need
Why is that? I mean, obviously, because you don't want to make a mistake, but why is that so important? Because, okay, you still, if you have a thorough due diligence, you're going to get to the bottom of it. Why would they get spooked so easy?
Because corporates, all they look at is risk. Okay. Once they've identified there's an opportunity, the rest of their time, 80% of their time is looking at risk. So if they find somebody's lied to them or someone's hiding information that they have to find themselves, they then worry that there's something else in due diligence that they've missed. Examples of that are I did an acquisition when I had my own business and the owner had promised discounts to a large amount of his customers in some time in the future. Shows up on no due diligence. And then after I buy the business, these customers, the main customers are coming up saying, I was promised 20% discount from here on in.
So what effect did that have on
It meant that my return for that acquisition was
low. So you had to honour the discount.
It did, because otherwise I paid for and bought those customers. And if I didn't give it to them, they would walk and go to a competitor. So I had to honour that discount. And because that was in the early days of my acquisitions, I didn't have any protection. I didn't have any bank guarantees. I didn't have any warranties against the seller. And these are things that when you're selling to a corporation, every single thing they do is around warranties and guarantees.
Is it fair to say that those warranties, guarantees and risk are more important than the money that they pay?
Correct. Yeah, without a doubt. Even if they think they're getting something cheap, they have to...
Well, I was going different way about it. They will pay more if they find that whatever was given to them is more secure.
Yes. If the seller has a good corporate solicitor and accountant and they can deal with those direct, corporates are much more comfortable than dealing through the owner, through a broker, and just taking bits and pieces of information. Whereas their accountants like to ring other accountants. They like to talk their language, get the answers they require quickly without going through three steps to get there. They are very a lot more comfortable if the seller's accountants and solicitors are have a more corporate slant. If they're a one-man band and they don't understand corporate contracts or how the P&L risks work, they tend to back off a little bit, or they increase their warranty requirements and guarantee requirements in the contract stage.
Yeah, that's one thing I've seen over the years, that whole deal is done and then the warranties and guarantees come up and he spooks the seller.
Yes.
But it's just the normal stuff. Like, they're asking you to warrant and guarantee past, not the future.
That's so correct.
Just tell me that. I just want all the information that was given to me. I just want some sort of guarantee from you. It's true and accurate. There's nothing wrong with that.
That is correct. But as a an agent for a seller, part of the responsibility is from day one is to, if you're going to sell to a corporate, is to explain to them that there are going to be things in the contract that will want personal guarantees. They want warranties against the information you have provided. And they say things like, well, what if I don't know about those things? And we say, well, they don't cover that. They're only covering the things that you have spoken about, the things you were given. If you don't know about them at the time, you can't disclose them. So they, you sort of got to talk it through with them. If you try and hide something or you decide to not tell your seller, it'll blow up in the 11th hour. It won't work. You still won't get the sale through because it won't get you to the point of a sale.
My question is now, so like if you've done one or two or three or five or 20 or 50 or you're a professional buyer or seller, you actually understand that. But most of the people that you're going to, I would imagine that you approached were private ownership.
Correct.
Private owners of private businesses. They run their business, you know, the way they feel like at any time, like get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, yep, as you said earlier, and get into it. So how did you bridge that gap? Like you're getting somebody from that environment that I call my shots and do whatever I want to corporate, selling to corporate.
It's not always simple. My style is reasonably direct. So you'll know where you stand fairly quickly when I'm offering you something or offering a service or trying to sell your business. So I do tell people fairly straight up, if the buyer is a corporate, I will explain that to them. Some people still don't get it, and they still don't get it until 4 minutes before they sign that contract.
I'll tell you why. Because what they want, they decided to exit the business, and I want a clear cut. Yes. I just want, you give me the money, you take the business. And the reason why I'm selling a business is because I don't want it anymore, and I don't want to stay connected. But you have to, because if somebody's giving you $10 million, they want some sort of guarantee that whatever they paid for, it's going to get delivered.
That's correct.
How do corporates normally pay for it? So let's say $10 million deal. How much can you expect on the day of the settlement or closing, and how much can you expect
it depends
later
on
what period of time?
It depends on the deals. A lot of the deals we did, they got the full amount, but they had to provide bank guarantees for, say, 20% of the value of the business. Whatever they identify as a risk with major customers. So if they're doing an acquisition and 40% of the revenue comes from two customers, or 50 or 60% comes from two customers, the rest of it's small. Some corporates won't even buy them. The risk's too high.
It's too great, yeah.
But if they do and there are one or two major customers, they work out what those are worth when you look at the multiple of the earnings that you're paying for them. Mm-hmm. And they will want that money guaranteed until those customers are signed over and they're staying with that new owner. It could be 6 months, could be 12 months. Sometimes it could be 2 years that they want, because they've paid a very large multiple, they want a longer period that those customers have to be guaranteed for. So the amount of money that's held back could be in a form of cash from the purchase price, or it could be a bank guarantee. With my business, it was a bank guarantee.
So you also said that you stayed with the business for about 18 months. Well, transition was 12 to 18 months. You stayed much longer.
Yes.
Working in this role.
Correct.
During those, so they paid all the money on the settlement. You had to provide some sort of bank guarantees. But they gave you opportunity to stay there and to actually control this transition.
Correct.
What did you find that worked? And what did you find that you would do differently or you wish they've done it differently during this 18 months?
It's surprising sometimes where big corporations, they don't actually know the best ways of running a business. So they have a lot of large teams that do things and they complicate things. So we would run a business, or even some of the other ones we've had, run businesses that are very profitable and very simple. So big corporations come in and put their processes in place. All of a sudden the profitability is gone and they'll say, you know, why has this happened? Where's the profit that we bought? And then you go through and explain that it's because of them, their costs have come into the business, and that's where the profit's gone. So, but they sometimes they'll allow you to go back to the way, but other times they'll say, no, well, this is, we have corporate costs, corporate rules, and it's going to be that way. So over time they realise too, they have to factor in the fact there's more costs in the business once they take it over than there is before they take it over.
That's also very dangerous when you're negotiating earnout. And it's negotiated on based on EBITDA or profitability of the business.
Yes,
but that needs to be defined very in great detail, so you don't have any issues like this when the corporate increase the cost and all of a sudden there's no profit to no fault of the
earnouts are very complicated. Yeah. I've seen a few that have worked, mm-hmm. But it's quite a few that haven't worked, and it's because the person. The old owner who has the earnout loses control. So they no longer have control of the costs. So if it's an EBITDA multiple, well, you're in trouble.
What I like with earnouts is to actually connect them to gross profit rather than bottom line.
Correct. Yep.
Because gross profit is much easier to, GP is much easier to control than the bottom line. I mean, what's a fair cost? What's an excess cost?
That's true. It can be manipulated too much if it's on the bottom line.
I don't think anybody wants to manipulate it. I just think that they creep in, like you just said, and then all of a sudden there's nothing. Well, you know, you bought what I sold you. Yeah. You ran it. You deal with it.
Yeah, that's correct. Yes, yeah.
And so that's one thing. What worked well? During the transition, what did you see? What would you say? Wow, this was really good. I wish I've done it earlier.
Transitions, you mean once the sales happened or before?
Once the sale, once when they took over the business or stayed with them.
Normally, if they don't change anything straight away, when they take over a business, you let it run the way it's been run for 6 to 12 months. It allows the staff to not worry about the loss of their jobs. It allows the customers to realise the prices aren't going up or the service levels aren't going to change. So you keep the face of the existing owner and the face of the existing team the same. So when you've paid money for a certain amount of revenue or a certain amount of EBITDA, it stays the same for a period of time. You then slowly introduce change if you want to introduce a change. Some businesses are left running exactly as they were with back-end reporting and accounting that captures all that side of it, but the front end stays as a separate entity from the overall business. So you still run it separately. So you don't change very, very much of it at all. When you run it like that, there's not a lot of synergies. Mm-hmm. So it does change how much people will pay for those businesses. But each individual business is different when it comes to that.
Mm-hmm. And we mentioned like the changeover a few times, and you talk about, we can talk about a cultural fit, but you know, cultural fit, is there a fit when the corporate's buying a private business? How much of a fit can you look for?
Yeah, it's quite often not. A lot of the times we've had the owners stay on for a period of time. It could be 6 to 12 months. It could be ongoing until each party decides. A lot of the time it doesn't last more than 3 months. The owner doesn't like the way the corporate is running his old business. He feels like he's been pushed out because they're running it their way. And sometimes the old owner tries to interfere too much with the buyer's way of doing things, and doesn't take long. And they both sit down and say, well, it's done now. We've transitioned our customers. We don't need your services anymore. And they go their separate ways.
Okay. And how's that normally done? I mean, does anybody lose out?
If there's an earnout, yes. That you probably wouldn't happen. Everyone would stick to the guns until the end of the earnout.
Yeah.
If there wasn't an earnout, the old owner takes his money, goes sailing around the world with his wife or whatever he wants to do, and the corporate then just takes it over and starts introducing a different culture and different management. They can lose staff when that happens, if it's done too quickly or too harshly. Huh. But majority of the time, it's not too bad.
One of the issues when the owners have when they're selling the businesses to corporates is, how am I team, how the people that have been with me for 10, 20 years going to be treated.
Yes.
And one of the things that the corporate's looking is, where can I save the money? Correct. So how do you deal with those dynamics, and how do you overcome that?
A lot of that's done before the acquisition is settled. You have those conversations with the staff, who wants to stay, who doesn't want to stay. Some of the corporates try and put things in contracts that says the staff must stay. And then you have the argument that the old owner can't guarantee the staff.
Well, he can't, because they're not part of the contract.
So then the buyer then puts that down as more risk, and then they increase their warranties based around the fact that staff may leave. They've got to get staff that are untrained to come back in. But on the staff side of it, if you're buying, especially these days, good staff are next to impossible to get. And buyers come in and they want the staff. Unless it's a real tuck-in and their savings are through those staff. But the couple that I've done recently, the staff are integral to the business, and they need those staff. So they're not going to do anything to jeopardize that.
So you said something a second ago that anybody listening to this probably had a mild heart attack, all right, just by hearing. But you said a lot of these things are done before acquisition. So I don't know how, but like in my world, for the buyer to talk to people that are selling the business before the deal is locked in, it's virtually impossible.
It's risky.
Yeah, very risky. Yeah. Like most of the owners are very uncomfortable with that.
Yes.
Because what happens? We're selling the business, no one knows, all of a sudden cat is out of bag, and how do we deal with this?
Yes.
All right. So like how often that happens, that conversation happens before? How often
with
after?
Us it was nearly always before.
So how did you get to it? Like how did you get them to agree to it?
It's normally when there's a heads of agreement in place, there's a 1 or 2 month exclusivity period.
Mm-hmm.
That things are going to go ahead unless there's something else that's found to stop it going ahead. With us, there's no contract signed until settlement and payments on settlement. There's no deposits. So if it's done afterwards, the staff feel a little bit let down that people did not bring them in on the conversation before it. So they do feel a little bit let down if you do it after settlement. But also, they really do need to know who's transitioning and what payouts have got to be done. It's got to be factored in. Sometimes it doesn't, and those payouts are put down as a holdback. And then over the periods, the couple of months after settlement, yep, if staff leave or there has to be redundancies made, that comes out of the holdback.
Yep.
That would have, because there wasn't a defined amount that could have been done before settlement.
So how do you do this conversation? How does it technically work? Because we've got a heads of agreement. In most of the cases, they're non-binding except for clauses.
That is correct. Yeah,
you're paying everything on the settlement. You're still going through due diligence. How do you convince owner to agree for you to talk to some key people in the business, while he or she doesn't have a 100% guarantee of this being completed?
With it depends on the corporate, but if they say we're not going ahead unless we can talk to your key staff, it's then up to the seller to make that decision. And somewhere along the line, you need to have that conversation with your staff. So if it doesn't go ahead afterwards, then the staff are aware you're selling it. And quite often, the sale process gets leaked anyway. If in an industry and you've got an industry buyer that's already in the industry, the drivers or the staff in that buying company are aware that we're buying someone else, the rumours do get around, so the staff start to hear about it before the sale's done anyway. So it is sometimes doesn't hurt, even if you are talking to the staff before settlement. The settlement doesn't happen, you just let the staff know then that it's being sold, because the chances are the staff will know about it before the sale goes through.
Look, you also already have a few acquisitions, so you've got a proven track record, and a few acquisitions under your belt, you've got a proven track record. So it gives a seller a lot of confidence.
Yes.
All right? And also gives people in the business, key staff that you want to talk to are the people that you want to stay.
Correct.
All right. So he actually increases their confidence, I would say.
It does.
You said something about the deposit. No deposit, no nothing. You actually pay everything on the settlement.
Yes.
Why is that the case?
It's with the large corporate that I was dealing with, that's just their policy. They just do all the paperwork, they do everything, okay, all the due diligence and everything, and then they just say, once it's on settlement, here's your check. Okay. Pay the whole amount.
But why is there the policy? Why not saying, hey, I'll give some goodwill deposit just to make sure that I'm serious? I mean, it's fully refundable, but I'll show you that I can write a check. You know?
It's probably because they had very deep pockets and people knew they had the money. The money wasn't, with them, the money wasn't an issue. And also the deposits aren't, they're all refundable. So it sort of was a bit of a token from thing from their side of it. If they hand over a couple of $100,000 deposit and they can take it back if they don't go ahead anyway. So it doesn't really mean they can or can't pay the money for it. So I think it's probably more with that company because they had a large amount of money and everyone was quite confident that they would pay. If from a seller's point of view, if you were dubious about the buyer or you weren't 100% sure whether they had the funds, then a deposit would probably be something which you would push for.
Mm-hmm. And in these acquisitions that you've done, or that you guys done over the time, are there any factors that you say, okay, this is going to be successful? Not in terms of successful purchasing of a business, but successful after the purchase. What are the factors that you were looking at for?
After purchase is really making sure everyone's communicating, making sure the customers, especially the key customers, are visited by both parties. So it's seen as a collaborative changeover. It's not just they've been bought, the old people are gone, who the customers got to know over 10, 15, 20 years. They do it together. So letters go out, one letter from the seller, one letter from the buyer. On that, it's giving you new bank details and new phone numbers and those sorts of things. So it's done together. So it's seen they're not losing the face of that the old owner. And it's not.
And for the larger customers, very important customer, would you go in person and see?
Oh, definitely, yeah. As many of the customers, especially anyone that's got more than a couple of percent of the revenue, you would definitely see them. So it sometimes can take months if you've got a large customer base, but it's very important that the customers feel important and in the whole process and that their service levels are not going to drop from where they were before the acquisition.
Any other points that are important?
Again, staff are the key things. So when you're buying a business, the key staff and your customers, they're the number one assets that you're buying, the trucks or the equipment or whatever else that comes with the business. It's there, but they can be replaced. It takes capital, but as long as they work for a period of time, they're not too bad. But the key thing is to make sure the communication with the staff.
People.
It's always people.
It's always people. Yep. And so if I asked you to, you know, and when that doesn't work, it's people again.
Oh, yeah, it is. Correct. Yep.
So he wasn't communicating well to customers it wasn't communicating well to staff.
That's correct. All right. So it's always that communication. If you upset your key salesperson, he disappears or she disappears with customer lists and their knowledge and the IP for your business.
Do you offer any incentives to them to stay?
No. No. If a big company is coming in on a small business, the incentive is that there's now a new line of promotion. There's new opportunities with a new company.
New career path. Yeah.
Correct. So I know a lot of people who are career focused really do enjoy the fact that a big company's bought their smaller business. Mm-hmm. So they do see that as an opportunity.
Okay. And can you give me any examples when this kind of went a little bit pear-shaped? That you can talk about, change the names and places
so yeah,
you can
to protect the innocent
and guilty for them.
Yeah, that's correct. Pretty much all of them went through reasonably well. We do have times when some of the staff still felt that they weren't basically people have been with the company for a long time and they weren't told about it beforehand, or they felt like they weren't treated properly after the acquisition.
Mm-hmm.
People do get their nose out of joint. And it's not necessarily money. It's more about feeling sort of wanted or needed in the business. So they feel like they lose a little bit of respect. So your staff, we did have times when staff left based around that.
Does it ever happen that when the staff leaves, it's actually a blessing in disguise that
yes.
you didn't
say? Yes, definitely.
Why is that the case?
Well, some staff feel that the business can't work without them. Yeah. And they're too in your face and they want to be involved and they want to make changes. And it's outside of what the business is going to be run like in the future. It's because the corporates have completely different ways of doing things. And some people have just become, they get a bit, again, it's their nose out of joint. They really want to show that they're part of this new team, and it ends up becoming more of an annoyance than a benefit.
Yeah. Look, I've seen when in multiple occasions that somebody appeared very important and they were in particular business, but that's because they were positioning themselves like that, all right? When in fact they were not, and it gets uncovered very quickly in change of the ownership.
It does.
And I've seen, you know, when they leave, everybody kind of goes, well, that was a good thing.
Yeah, that's right.
But I've seen it the other way as well, when you've got a really good people and that they don't really like the acquirer.
Yes.
And when they leave, and it's not a really good thing.
No, but
there's
not.
No one to blame rather than the purchase.
Yep.
Rather than the purchaser.
That's correct.
Yeah. So how do you keep a key talent? Like you said, you rather than giving them potential for growth, how do you you said you don't pay any bonuses or anything like that, or are there exceptions to that, or what else can one do to actually keep them?
Corporates tend to have bonus schemes,
yeah,
which is just part of the company. It's not necessarily part of the acquisition. So when the people come on, the key staff may fall under their existing bonus structure of that company. So they do have an opportunity to earn more money because of that. So that's one way of doing it. Some key people may walk into a higher role within the overall bigger business. So if it's a tuck-in business into an existing business group that's with a corporation, they may step into a management role because they have more skills than the existing people in the company.
Mm-hmm. I just want to go back to financials and money matters.
Yeah? Yes, it does.
What I found that corporates pay more, so they want more security, but in general they pay more.
Yep.
So when you're selling to corporates, you got to weigh these two things. All right, well, I'm giving some guarantees and warranties, and I've got this problem that I got to maybe expose some of my key staff to the fact that the business is selling before I know that's 100% done deal. Yep. But in return, what I'm getting, I'm actually getting more money than somebody who doesn't have a synergy in their business will pay. And also, for you as a corporate, when you're approaching a target that's not thinking of selling, well, you have to give them incentive.
You do, correct.
To sell now rather than later. Otherwise, yes. Well, if you're giving me what the market's going to pay, I'll just wait when I'm ready and I'll sell it to market. So, is there any advice you can give to somebody that gets approached by corporate? How should they handle the whole process? What to consider and how to get the best out of it?
I think the best advice is just to let them know that there's going to be a process that they've never been involved with before, the due diligence. There's going to be a lot of information that they may think is not important, which corporations, they have a checklist. And if you go down, you've skipped 4, 7, 21, you think it's gone. Somewhere along that process, they'll come back and say, hang on, we haven't got number 4, 7 or 21. And the information doesn't necessarily, is it that important for the actual acquisition? But the corporation has a duty of care and they need all those gaps. Even if it's an NA or the response is not,
you don't have
the information, you need them to put an answer in. So there's those sorts of cultural things that they've got to get used to. they've also got to be aware that they are going to have an opportunity to get more money by selling to a corporation. So they have to play by their rules a bit as well, and allow the process to happen. If you try and short circuit a process with a corporate, it won't happen.
Yeah, well, is it fair to say that the reason why I'm saying is it fair to say because I don't know, all right? But yes. Like, I'm just working from my experience that normally corporate person that's handling the deal or anybody that's involved in the deal, they really worry about their position a little bit more.
Yes, I do.
I want to make sure that my job is still safe after yes. this purchase.
Yeah.
I really don't care how much we pay to a certain extent, unless that's I'm the one making decision on that, because that's not important to me. What's important to me, that all boxes are ticked.
That's correct.
And I find very frustrating for the private person selling a business to that, but just play the game, go through the process, understand what's important to them,
yes,
and help them purchase the business by giving them that information. And often in some of these checklists, there are most ridiculous things
yes.
that definitely don't apply. Goes in, give me your written minutes of your director's meetings for the last 12 months. Well, there is no single one.
No, that's correct.
That never exists. Yeah. But it's there, and you got to explain why and how not. You just got to give them information.
You need an answer, and you're right. It's there to protect the buyer in the position that he's in, that his job's not going to be lost because he forgot to ask a question. So the questions are there. They're standard. They ask them for, doesn't matter if it's a small acquisition or a big, they still have very similar questions, and it's not relevant to a lot of the businesses, but you have to have an answer of some sort in there. And it is to protect that person's role within the business. But as a broker, it's your role is to let the seller know
and help them through the process
that it's going to happen. And a lot of the time when you get to contract stage, all the things that they've talked about that the sellers think is never going to be brought up again, they're documented. And it's not just a paragraph. Sometimes it's three pages in a contract that talks about the thing that we touched base on during the process. And then they start getting very upset, and I get the phone calls, I'm pulling out, I'm not going to agree to this. And it's then a matter of saying, well, remember we spoke about it right at the start. This is what they were talking about. Oh, well, that sounds different. I said, it's not different. It's the same thing. It's just written by a solicitor.
And it's all about risk mitigation from the purchaser's point of view. And the risk 100%. Comes in all sorts of different ways. Like, it could be individual risk. It could be lawyer's risk. It could be corporation risk. You know? So everything needs to be covered.
It is. And there's risk at every different level. You're right.
Can you give me an example of something like that was needed to be negotiated in or documented in too many words?
Any precise things, but most of it's contract. Most of it's goes along flowing quite nicely until the solicitors get involved. And when they get involved, they make suggestions to the buyer, and the buyer, again, won't go against what their advisors are saying, because they're paying the money to be their advisors on a legal side. If they say, I want this put in a contract, then it happens a lot. And then the buyers say, well, we can't not do it. Otherwise, when we go to our shareholders, they'll say, hang on, that fell apart. You went against the advice of the solicitors. And so it gets...
And the solicitors trying to protect themselves. So often they're going to not be commercial on certain things because they need to protect themselves, which then turns into advice which you have to follow. So you have to understand the dynamic of that and just work through it.
Yes.
As funny as that is, the deal always gets to the end. Well, not always, but it does. If you really push forward, you will get it to the end.
But as a broker, you have to be there the whole time. You have to take the phone calls. You have to, no matter how many times you've been over it with the seller, you've got to talk to them, and you've got to take them through the process again and again. And when it comes down to individual paragraphs and individual parts of the contract, it's a matter of talking to them and their own solicitors and saying, this is the reason that's in there. It's not for any other reason. And then they'll say, oh, that's the case. We want this clause changed.
So what happens is, from the seller's point of view, they just feel, okay, I've got these guarantees, or I've got an earn out, and they think they're trying to set me up, but it's not the case.
That's correct. Yeah.
I'm just being simple here, the way it is. And they actually do say, oh, like, I can't do that. I know what they're going to try to do.
Yes.
I'm sick. I'm pulling out. And like there's a saying that every deal, you know, dies four times before you get it to the end.
That is correct.
So you just got to go through the motions. You got to go through the process. But what's very important is to explain to seller why that's in there. Just accept it. Like, understand why they need it. All right.
And it's always in there for a reason.
Yep.
The buyer has a reason. And if you talk to them, they'll tell you what it is. You then have to explain that to the seller. And after a while, after they've spoken to their own legal advisors, they then get an understanding of why it's in there. And they'll either ask for their own change or they'll accept it. But it does take time. And if you ignore it, the deal will fall over.
But sometimes the purchaser has to be commercial and say, well, I know what your lawyer is saying to you, and I know what you're saying to you, but like somewhere along the line, we have to both parties have to take a certain amount of risk.
Yes.
All right? There's no such thing like risk-free transaction. All right? So in all of this, you have to be commercial. So you have to look at the whole deal as a whole. From the seller's point of view, I mean, how much money and in what terms you're getting for this?
Yep.
And if you can do better, by no means, tell these people to go, right? But if the deal is much better than what you can go get on the open market, well, work through it. From the purchaser's point of view, from the corporation, don't get bogged down in the little risk mitigation tactics and lose the commercial part of the deal, which is... C-suite will make that decision, but the people below them won't.
No, that's correct.
Because the CEO and CFO, their bonuses directly, indirectly corrected the profitability of the business because it's connected to the price of the shares. And they will do this they will make these tough decisions in order to get a commercial outcome, while anybody below them, you know, no. They don't. They only see the risk for their positions. So you really have to understand, I'd say, how the purchaser thinks, and then you have to adjust your negotiating technique based on who you're selling your business to.
That is correct. Yeah. Depending on who your CEO is, if he has an accounting background, so you end up with two accountants, a CFO and a CEO, both from the same background, it becomes very... there's no emotion attached to it at all. It's just black and white, and they're very abrupt. So it can put people off, but they're interested in the money only, the results. If you have a CEO that's a sales background or an operations background, they then have a different slant on what's important for that acquisition, and they will take more of the risk and say, no, I think we should do this because, as you said, their bonuses are attached to share price is attached to profitability, and everyone wants that same result. So even though they might be giving a bit away from a risk side, the upside is so much more to them that they will still push it through.
That's fantastic advice, because you can actually, nowadays with LinkedIn and all the publications and all the reporting, and you can actually do really good research.
Yes.
On people you're dealing with. So while you're dealing with a corporation, there's still people within that drive the corporation. So you got to do the research on the key decision makers.
Yep.
And then... well, position your negotiation based on how they go about the stuff.
Yep.
Or in some cases, say, well, this is never going to happen, so walk away.
Yeah, from that's the right. Yeah, yeah.
To a hard basket.
Yeah, they're too far apart from each other. Never going to join.
Yeah, yeah.
No, it is important. The structure of the buyer or the corporation around bonuses and commissions is, for years, I've always wondered whether commissions are a good thing, because if you get them wrong, you get the targets wrong, and then they're manipulated by the people who are getting those bonuses to get a result for them. May not be great for the company. So it's always risk associated with dealing with bonus schemes and commission structures, especially salespeople.
Yeah.
They can manipulate any commission structure to get the best result for them.
Yeah.
So you've got to look at that when you're trying to sell to one of them, to see who's there, what it could be, what are the reasons for their bonuses. You know, I've had situations where bonuses have been based around from the accounting side of the business about debtor days and debtor and creditor days. So what they do is they stop paying their suppliers because it makes the cash flow better.
Okay, so the balance looks different.
So all of a sudden, all their suppliers are not getting paid, And this was another major corporate I was dealing with. And they had a lot of contracts with the airports and things like that. They shut them down overnight because they hadn't paid their bills. The CEO didn't even know about it. But all the accountants were getting paid based on those results.
Accountants getting paid bonuses, yeah, but the business suffers here because you're upsetting clients. Yeah.
So there's a really, really strong structure around
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. Yeah. Let's go that way. So when your job was a corporate acquisitions, so what were your KPIs? And how did you go about it?
Mine were very black and white. I got a percentage of what I sold.
Purchased.
So, yeah. Yeah. Purchase, which is a little bit against it because if I get the prices higher, I get paid more money, which is a bit strange for somebody that's using me as a buyer's agent. They prefer to have the lower dollar. But I work on the theory that if the price is too high, the buyer won't buy it. If it's too low, the seller won't sell, and I won't get a deal. So no matter who I worked for, it was important that I communicated with both sides and I got a result that made everybody feel that had an overpaid or got underpaid, and then the deal went ahead. It's no good me trying to push that price down as low as possible. The seller's going to feel like he's been ripped off.
Well, he's not going to sell.
No, and he'll just pull out at some stage. Yeah. Once it gets too complicated or once he gets too much pressure on, if it's already at a very low price for the seller, he's going to say, forget it. If he's got some good money left in it for the seller, they can put up with some of those problems to do with due diligence. They say we can accept that because the price is high.
It goes back to how good is the deal overall.
Yes.
And what am I giving more than my risk is in the deal from the seller's point of view.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
Similar with the buyer. Okay, well, I'm paying a little bit more, but look what I can do this in the future.
Yeah. It's also important, I think, for the broker to be involved at transition, the start of the transition. You don't have to be there on a daily basis, but you need to be there to still be that liaison between the buyer and seller while the seller is still working to help with the consolidation.
Especially at the beginning, those few first weeks.
Yes, definitely. If you walk away, they feel like they've been abandoned by you and they're just left with this big company telling them what to do. Yep. They have no one to talk to. So very important that the brokers stay with the deal after they've got their check and making sure. And in the long run, that works in your favour. You do get referrals. You do get people talking
Look, often when somebody approaches you to help them with selling a business, they're actually asking the wrong questions. The question is, how many of these have you sold? Where are you going to find a buyer? Look, you find a buyer, all right? Your buyer will find you. especially today with technology and everything else, and databases and everything else. It's what happens once when you find a buyer and start negotiating. That's where you need a good advisors all the way. Not just until you get the money in the bank, but like you said, after that, when you're doing this transition, are they there to help? And a lot of advice, good advisor, good broker, good M&A advisor, whoever's helping you through a process will give you, they will help you after the transition.
It's very important.
Yeah.
It's also good for the broker because he learns what happens after a sale. He learns the downside and the upside, what risks there are. So when you're approached by the next seller, you have an understanding of what happens after consolidation of the business. So you can then advise your sellers better than you were before because you have more experience.
Because you gain the experience. You gain the experience. Most of people sell business once, twice. Most of people sell their good sell. They go once in a lifetime.
Correct.
So if you are the broker that went through many of these deals, you need to share that's what they're employing you for, that experience of the deal.
That's correct.
Not to find a buyer.
No. And another plus on my side I found is that I had my own business for 13 years. So I built it up from scratch. I got it to the point where I had it for sale, sold it, and I've been through the whole due diligence process with the corporation. I've been there after the sale because I was part of the transition team. So I do it from a level of confidence because I've actually been there and done it. So anything with experience when it comes to for people to sell the business, having a broker that's been a part of that whole process is a good reference.
I was going to say something earlier, but then I decided not to. But now this is a good time to bring it up, all right? Because sometimes when you're selling to corporate, you may going to deal with a person that's not experienced.
Yes.
You're dealing with, for lack of a better word, junior who happened to be in this position. And now all of a sudden he was given this task to actually negotiate these things. and they don't have that experience. They you know, not that they're young, but just don't have that experience.
Yep.
And if you're selling to somebody like that, you have to have a look also where are they in their life cycle, so you can figure out how to deal with them. If somebody doesn't have experience, well, you're gonna have a different conversation to somebody who already bought 20 businesses, all right? Because they're looking at this totally different. And you can feel, maybe as a seller first time, you can't feel that. But if you're an advisor, if you're helping people sell businesses, you should know that
in
the first meeting who you're dealing with, correct. And adjust yourself accordingly.
Yeah. Yep. And that's the thing, if you offer to assist the buyer in that situation, to say, not going to tell them how to do their job, but these are key things you could look at when you're looking to buy this business. You can actually help the buyer and you get a little bit of assistance in the whole process if you look after that buyer.
Got to be very careful. Like, I 100% agree.
Yes.
I have seen that when you're trying to help a buyer, that seen from the seller's point of view and seller's advisors, hey, whose side you're taking? Look, let me just get this right. I'm on the side of the deal.
Yeah, right? That's correct.
Because if the deal doesn't happen, no one gets anything in return.
That's
all right?
What I say.
So you got to help. Absolutely. My loyalty is to the seller. I will never do anything if I'm on the seller's side.
Yes.
That's going to compromise the seller's position. But sometimes buyer needs a help. It may going to look like I'm working on the other side, for the other side, but I'm not, all right? Yes. I'm working on the deal because unless you have a willing buyer and willing seller, there is no deal.
It won't happen, that's correct. And it's important to let the seller know that's what you're doing as well. I find if you try and hide anything in any of these processes, it'll come out and you'll get caught and you'll look like you're doing something wrong. If you are helping the buyer to get through part of the process, let your seller know.
Yeah, be transparent.
Just tell them how it is. If they turn around and say, there's no way I want you to do that, then you don't do it. They're paying your bill. But you need to explain to them that if you don't get them through this deal could be dead in the water.
Yeah.
I think the whole process, it needs to be clear, transparent communication.
Also, another advice I'd give to people is don't make up these deadlines and take it or leave it or something like that, unless you really mean it.
Yeah, that's right? Correct.
Because if you put one deadline or one condition
that
says, well, this is not conditioned, and then you change your position,
that
means everything else not going to be taken seriously.
No.
So never put it unless it's done by Friday. There's no deal. That's a silly thing. It's counterproductive.
That's correct.
The deals don't happen overnight. They have to take their time.
Especially if you're the seller and you're saying that to a corporate. Corporate will just say, well, it doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
We have 15 deals going on at the time.
And we've got a chain of command. It has to go up and come back down.
Our law firm's there. We have a board meeting that happens on the 25th of the month.
Yeah.
It's now the 26th, so we're not going to have another board meeting for another month.
Yeah.
We can't make any decisions on this until that happens. So there's lots and lots of things that happen all the way along that means it can't be done by Friday. Even if everyone's happy for the deal to go ahead, it's not going to happen.
And often people say, so why should I deal with somebody that, you know, hasn't got the control and the process lasts so long and much longer than, because they pay more. It's just, if you're lucky enough that you're good acquisition for the corporate target, that's your ticket to freedom, my friend.
Correct.
That's where you're going to get that extra bonus, like
that's
over
right.
and above the market value. Yeah,
that's correct. So the corporates have that infrastructure in place. They have the ability to get synergies. And they have the ability, even at what seems like a high price to you, it's a good buy price for them because of the synergies.
Yep.
So everyone wins. The seller gets higher money and the buyer makes more profit because they have synergies. So it's if you understand the synergies, if you understand the business that the buyer's in, you can understand those synergies and you may know that you can actually get another 20% out of them because it's with synergies that still is less than 2.5x EBITDA.
So my advice for anybody who that gets approached by the corporate and said, listen, we're interested in doing, don't dismiss them. Always sit down and talk.
Yeah.
You're going to learn something even if you're not selling.
That's correct,
There are people that get paid. That's their job. They'll talk to you, not wasting anyone's time, all right? Sit down. You're going to learn a lot. But then again, you know, they may going to be offered that you're going to say, well, I'd be silly not to refuse.
Always talk.
One thing I would say, don't get just to get the indicative offer, try to do it as quickly as possible because the danger is if you're going back and forward for, and I've seen it, 6 months or 12 months, and then eventually the offer comes in that's not good enough for me. You wasted your focus wasn't on running a business. You were focused on selling a business.
Correct.
And during that time, you made some decisions and said, well, I'm not going to do this capital investment. I'm not going to try to do this because this guy's going to buy anyway and it's going to cost me money, so I'm just losing. So
yep.
my advice to people in those situations is if you ever get approached by corporate and say, we are interested in buying you out, sit down, have a conversation, then say, listen, tell me what you need and let's put a timetable on this just for you to give me an indicative offer. Let's do something reasonable, say 8 weeks. I'll give you all the information just for that, not for the due diligence, for you to come back and say, look, if all this stacks up, we'll give you X. If the offer is right, I'll accept it. If the offer is not right, we're going to stop it.
That's pretty much the way I've done all the acquisitions.
Yeah.
It's a very quick 1 week process. You get the P&Ls, you do the adjustments, you put a value based on that, you say, this is what we will pay if due diligence backs up the financials you've given us. And then you get that nod straight away, and then it may take another 2 months after that to consolidate the numbers and to prove that what you were given was correct. And my advice that you brought up before is with anyone selling the business, you run your business like it's not being sold.
Yeah, absolutely.
You buy new equipment if you need to, if it's going to jeopardize the business, you don't invest in capital unless you have to, but you employ new people if you have to, you do whatever it takes because it could take a year with a corporate before anything happens, and it also may not happen. So you don't want to, as you said, just sit there sitting on your hands, not running your business properly. It starts to suffer, and in the end the sale doesn't go through. You're way behind mentally. You're in a struggle too because you've mentally sold it and you stopped running your business.
Correct.
So you've then got to restart your own process to
get. Look, if it's a serious investment in the business during the process, you should really consider potential purchaser and don't just go and do it and say, listen, I need to invest, you know, $1 million in this equipment.
Yes.
Especially if it's a larger investment.
Capital, say,
Yeah. Because they may going to have something on their end. All right. Yes. But then again, if the deal doesn't go through, like I missed the opportunity. But conversation, communication.
Again, you have to be open with them on that. Yeah. So, and I've had that conversation with people that haven't really been ready to sell. So being approached by people, I think it's important for business owners to talk to them, even if they're not ready to sell, because people don't understand from where they are today can be completely different to where they need to be to sell the business.
Yep.
People who are working in the business themselves, no matter how big the business is, they've become an integral part of that business. When you sell it, it's a real problem because they're going to want you to stay. You want to retire. If you retire, then all of a sudden a key person that brings in 40% of their revenue is going to leave. So you have to get the business to a point where you manage yourself out of the business. So when someone buys it, they can take it on and there's no risk associated with the owner. It's important for people to understand.
So you get, easier said than done, but it's perceived risk associated with the owner, because sometimes even though maybe I'm face of the business, I got such a good product or service that people will buy no matter who.
Yes,
who sells that to them.
Yes.
But I can't guarantee that. And you don't know that.
No.
And there may going to be the case, yep. Especially the purchaser is going to see that as a risk.
Yes.
Right?
Yep.
So even if that's the case, if you're the public-facing or customer-facing person, it is an issue. So, and if you're so confident that that's not going to affect the business, well, put somebody else in that place.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
It's just transition is easier.
It is. It makes it a lot easier. Yep.
Yeah. Well, Stuart, I think we had a really good conversation.
Oh, we did. Yeah.
any other, final advice you could think of that said anything that we missed that you think it would be good to share to anybody who's thinking of selling to corporates or gets approached by corporates to sell?
I think we've covered most of it, but I think a seller, even though we're the brokers, I think it's important they have a good broker, only because there will be, as you said, the deal fails four times before it succeeds type of thing within the deal. you need someone that you can talk to that's not the buyer. Because you talk to the buyer, you always think there's something on their side. If you've got a broker that's in between, when the buyer yells it and screams at the broker, you don't ring up and yell and scream at the seller. You change it, you make it, and you say, this is a problem the buyer's got, and you say it in a different format. I think it's important to have that advice, but it's also important to get advice along the way on how to get the business ready to sell. People I've approached, and they've got all their BASs in a box under their desk. They do BAS once a year, and no one knows how much what their costs are because they only put their bills in once a year because they own the business. The cash is their own in their bank account. They just spend it, and at the end of the year, they go through and try and work it out. That business is very hard to sell because a buyer from a corporate point of view can't see any structure. They don't exactly know what the costs are in our business. So that's a bit of a far right example of that one. But it's important that a business is ready to sell. So talking to a broker or talking to your accountant before, 1 year, 2 years even before you sell, you're ready to sell, is important so that you're ready. And if a company's talking to you, listen to them, see what they've got to say. I mean, even if you're not ready to sell, they'll ask questions, will give you an idea of what they're looking for when they look at your business.
So one thing, you absolutely have somebody that's going to advise you or project manage whole place and have a whole deal and have a broker or advisor in between. But another thing is also involve your accountant, your lawyer, and your advisor, broker together.
Yes.
Don't let them work on their own because they work in their own domain and they see the risk in the deal from their point of view.
They do.
You really have to have them working as a team.
Yep. That's correct.
Excellent, Stuart. Thank you very much for your time. This
was
fantastic.
That was great. Thank you very much.
Well done.
Thanks. Bye.
Need help selling your business, buying a business, or a business valuation? Exclusive Business Sales award-winning team are here to help. Our experience, skill, expertise, and professionalism, backed by our triple guarantee, is assurance for your success. The largest network of buyers and our national coverage will help you throughout Australia in all state capitals and regional areas. Exclusive Business Sales. Sell your business with certainty.